My name is Jimmy, and I just have one simple impulsive question.
Are you in love?
What?
At the present time, are you in love?
Why?
Because if you are, then I won't waste your time. I'm really not the type of man to impede another man's happiness. However, if you're not presently in love, then I will continue my rhapsody, because if I may say so, Dagny, you are most definitely the bee's knees.
Does this rap ever work?
Alas, in the old days. Now I rarely get a chance to try it, but you haven't answered my question.
I got it.
Are you in love?
Well, there is someone.
But?
We date. I have memorized his phone number, but I won't use his toothbrush. We're somewhere in between. And he's crazy about me.
As he should be. You glide.
I glide?
You glide. It's a very attractive quality. Most girls, they merely plod along. You, on the other hand, you glide.
Welcome to part two of our Things to Do in Denver When You Are Dead and You're Andy Garcia episode. But before we go into real talk, it's time for PP, our patron pitch. This is where we let our patrons know what they can expect on our exclusive patron feed. We also let non-patrons know what they're missing out on. So, as mentioned pretty much at every patron pitch, the Cutting Room Floor segments are open to every patron, whether you're on the dollar tier or the $10 tier. Everybody gets access to the stuff that doesn't make it to the main feed episodes, stuff that we cut for time, stuff that we cut because it's too much of a digression, that you can get from the ground floor. We also get access to the chat, which is where we give you updates, if you're a patron, about where we are on the editing, what we're watching at the time, even if sometimes it's not stuff that we're watching for the show.
There's also plenty of opportunity for banter as well.
Yes. And if you want to criticize Alex's opinions, that seems to be a good place to do it also.
And I read that shit and I get in there. So keep your dukes up.
He doesn't take it personally, though. He goes in and takes the criticism in stride and promises to do better.
Yes.
And then also, as a patron of any denomination, you have access to the bonus episodes. So this month for April, it's the much anticipated team up with the Filmbusters, Adam, Ben, Paul. They came over to Contrarian's headquarters via the internet, and we talked about Dancer in the Dark, the Lars von Trier movie starring Bjork. It's a musical. It's a Lars von Trier musical. Who would have thought that such a thing existed? But it's been on our planet for 2 decades now. So it's a very interesting movie. I think it's a very interesting discussion. There's five of us, each of us with a very different point of view. Should be a lot of fun. So you get access to all of that just from the ground floor. Now, if you want more, you get more by moving up a tier. So if you go to the Widonies, the $3 tier, you get access to our pre-recording notes. You get access to our QVRs. This month, it's a dual quick video review. Alex and I are tackling Glengarry Glen Ross, demanded by the same man that demanded Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead. Patron Ben Murray, Glengarry Glen Ross is one of his favorite movies. Sometimes, some days, it's his favorite movie. Directed by James Foley, written by David Mamet. Cast of all stars. It gets the dual QVR treatment, so check that out. And then, of course, you also get access to Contrarians After Hours. That's the spin-off show where we tell you about other things that we're watching, that we're reading, that we're listening to, that we're playing. And this time, Alex proposed we do a double feature to cover together. Mm-hmm. Alex, what are we doing for Contrarians After Hours?
We're going to the Roadhouse for a double feature. Fitting, as patrons will remember recently, my After Hours eulogy of sorts for the one-of-a-kind, arguably and widely recognized in most circles as the greatest of all time professional wrestler, Terry Funk, as he has a part in the first one of these. And then secondly, I am a fan of the world of mixed martial arts and our most widely known representative of that. And as bad as that is a gentleman by the name of Conor McGregor. And he stars opposite Jake Gyllenhaal in the Roadhouse remake. So we're going back to the 80s with Patrick Swayze and then to present day on Amazon Prime for a movie that has been receiving not good reviews. The lead into the release, of course, was riddled with interesting tales of Jake Gyllenhaal trying to get a theatrical release, and some of the press scrum footage from following the release has some pretty concerning footage of Conor McGregor. So there's a lot of things outside of these movies that I could go on about, but I think it's topical. And also, Julio and myself, I don't know of a time where it's ever going to come where we actually cover Roadhouse on the podcast proper. So it felt like the right time to double it up, get some Swayze in our life and some Jake G.
I have never seen Roadhouse and I was not planning on watching the remake, but now I am. So there you go.
The main thing is that I texted you and I was, there's too many people that have reached out to me about it, wanting to know what I think or wanting to let me know what they think. And
you're like, might as well make it content.
I guess. Cause it's the Connor thing. It's like, dude, I got off that train years ago, but we'll see. Optimistic wouldn't be the word I would choose, but you know, at least we'll get some Swayze and Sam Elliott and Terry Funk in our life, and then we'll see whatever the fuck came out on Amazon Prime last week.
I am down. So that will be the after hours. And then if you want to be part of those patrons that tell us what to do, like Ben did with this episode, then you kick it up to the $5 tier, the Embrace, or the $10 tier, the Gats. And then that will give you the chance to tell us what to do in the main feed, what to do in the patron feed, what to do with the videos. You can just go to patreon.com/contrarianprime, look at what we're offering and see how you would like to join the Contrarian Supplements.
$1, $3, $5, and $10. Julio outlined our respective tiers there. We have our current patron goals. Once we cross certain thresholds, we'll be providing patron-exclusive mini-series. But there's already some there for consumption, be it our Roxina, our Lindsay Lohan, our Summer Break trilogy. There's a whole lot of goodness to be beheld over on our patron page. So check it out. And if you have any questions about it, you can reach us on Patreon or preemptively through our email account. We are thecontrarians@gmail.com. To our current patrons, we love y'all. Continue to, let us know what you think about episodes or just what you're watching in general in the chat. I've really enjoyed that part of it, is staying in touch with the community, as they say. And as I like to always end this spiel with, we are accepting applications for new patrons. They will be quickly reviewed and approved.
Now, Alex, before we jump in Andy Garcia's convertible and head back to Denver, quick reminder, live stream for The Cure. We're going to be raising money for cancer research alongside Nick Haskins and the rest of the gang. The event runs from May 29th to June 1st. The Contrarians, that's Alex and I, will be there on the last day, June 1st, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. Central. If you live somewhere else in the world, just do a quick Google or send us a message, ask us, we'll help you figure out when exactly is it that we're going to be doing our live stream segment. But I mean, we'll be there the entire event. We're always there in the chat participating, but our segment, which is tentatively titled The Contrarians versus Walt Disney, will be June 1st, 5 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Central. And yes, that will be Alex and I taking suggestions from the audience and doing mini contrarian treatments for any Disney animated movie. It should be a lot of fun. We'll have four tiers like the last couple of years that we've done this. There'll be rewards for the main feed if we hit certain donation goals. We'll explain this as we get closer. But for now, just know, live stream for The Cure, May 29th to June 1st. Contrarians versus Walt Disney, specifically June 1st, 5 p.m. Eastern. That will be fun, we promise. Now, Alex, take us to real talk.
Jimmy, you got the nice suit, you got the $70 haircut, but you are taking a dump in your video business. I got a call in the note.
You know who didn't have fun was the general public with this movie.
Why?
Well, the quickest answer I could give you is that Casino came out a week before it.
Oh, no.
Casino came out a week before, as did Toy Story. And then the weeks after this, Jumanji came out. It didn't really have any competition on its day of release. White Man's Burden, the John Travolta film, and then Wild Bill, that I believe that was Jeff Bridges. And it just couldn't stand up to Casino, obviously.
So we have gangsters at home.
Exactly. And it was just the end of 95. There was a lot going on. 2 weeks after it came out, Heat was released. And, you know, Toy Story was just fucking juggernaut. And obviously these are different types of movies, but that still was just overtaking. And it was just a terrible time to drop this. And on top of all that, I can only imagine the newspaper reviews everywhere were just saying this was, you know, a cheap ripoff of a Tarantino film, which the opening credits of this, you know, exactly, you're living in the world where Pulp Fiction just dropped like an atomic bomb and it was still just kind of settling over everything that was happening. That those shots of him driving to the kind of somber music. And yeah, this is a very strange melding of a 90s action film in a post Pulp Fiction world. And I assume some of the quotes you have for us here also make reference to that. I know one specifically, but as far as why it failed, I think it would be the critical reception. And then, as I just listed, all of the movies that surrounded it were just way, way too much to try to compete with. The good news is it wasn't the biggest box office failure of December 1995, as Cutthroat Island came out on December 22nd.
Gina Davis just looked at Andy Garcia and gave him the nod. I got this.
The end of Dark Knight Rises at the cafe. She just sees him and nods to him.
All right. Well, let's get these fresh quotes out of the way so we can get to Ben's message, because that's a real important one. But let's start with Rob Gonzalez from Rob's Movie Vault, who says, "Funny and engaging what's it that didn't really deserve all the comparisons to Quentin Tarantino." Or you could just not bring up Tarantino at all.
Yeah, for real.
Mike Clark from USA Today says, "Yet another debut about urban lowlifes filmed by wannabe Tarantinos. Denver boasts a distinctive personality and a colorful cast that any police lineup would be proud to call its own." So it started talking down to it, and then it ended up positive. This is a great cast, Alex. Can we agree
that? Oh, yeah. And some of these people really shine.
Yeah, I was not kidding about Christopher Lloyd in Katrina's Corner. I think that scene is amazing. He puts on a great performance. Yep. And it does make you think, like, man, I haven't gone digging down Christopher Lloyd's filmography, you know, but I think that I am with the average person when I just don't see him as anything other than Doc Brown. And that's plenty, you know, but still, then to see him do something like this is great. We'll get into it. And then final quote is rotten, as referenced in Katrina's Corner. Roger Ebert from the Chicago Sun-Times. He says, "It's so overwritten, it becomes an exercise in style rather than a story about its characters. On balance, I think it's an interesting miss." So, you know, he didn't hate it. It's not Friday the 13th.
To finish that, I have the remainder of the quote pulled up in front of me here. "I think it's an interesting miss, but a movie you might enjoy if A, you don't expect a masterpiece, and B, you like the dialogue in Quentin Tarantino movies."
Couldn't help himself. I mean, that is a very fair statement, but I also think that there's more to it than that. And because I enjoyed the dialogue in Quentin Tarantino movies. And I don't go into most movies expecting masterpieces, especially if they're movies from filmmakers that I'm not familiar with.
Oh, yeah.
But there are plenty of Tarantino wannabes, Tarantino copycats, whatever you want to call them, that have not worked at all for me. I always bring up Lucky Number 11. Mm-hmm. that came a few years after that, because I was already living in the States when that came out. But that's still, you know, sometimes I think that the artifice, the lack of a point of view other than I want to do it like Tarantino, like I think that sometimes that's stronger than what I felt while I was watching this movie. With this movie, I felt that they were trying to do their own thing, but you can't escape the comparisons.
Yeah, and it's also, just on top of it, it's a mirror. Dude, there are parts of this that feel so... and as we know about the Weinsteins going back in and just like, no, fuck this, chop this up, do this. There are segments of this movie that feel like Miramax intervened to try to make it seem more like Pulp Fiction, because some of the stuff that feels like it was originally part of the movie, namely the entire story with Dagny. Like, there's these parts in this that are like, you know, some of the great 90s action movies like Speed, where it's like emotional character development. Oh, we learned these people are damaged, and oh, the romance and the kind of sweet, you know, romantic music now is playing in the background. And then with this, and then they go to the, like the funeral home where they store the bodies under the real corpses. And then they're all standing at like the cemetery with all these slang terms and like this hip dialogue that they have. And it feels like studio expectation of remaking Pulp Fiction ran head first. Like we have that studio expectation of just a Pulp Fiction light. And then you have this ideology from another side that wants to make a 90s action movie, like a True Lies or something. And they just ran full force into each other and they kind of just, it fell together. And so there's these scenes that'll happen back to back that have no tonal consistency whatsoever. It's a movie that literally could only exist in the mid 90s, specifically 1995. I was so much more fascinated by this movie than I would say I enjoyed it. There are individual performances, moments I really enjoy, but just it's such a timestamp. You know what I mean?
Yes. I think that, and we'll get to Ben's message in a minute, but I want to say that I know that I, maybe that's the difference between Lucky Numbers 11 and something like Things to Endeavor When You're Dead, that Lucky Numbers 11 was made in the 2000s. And so it just missed the boat as far as my nostalgia window. This being made in the middle of the 90s, somehow it gives it an advantage when I'm watching it. Because you're right, I recognize it. And I don't even know if I can exactly put it into words, but it's the Miramax logo, the assortment of actors as the credits are coming up, the music and the, yeah, even the aspiration to be, if you want to say that it's aspiring to be a Pulp Fiction or a Tarantino movie, then it's also there. And somehow, because it's set in the 90s or because it came from the 90s, that works a little bit of magic on me. And I think that maybe by the time that it's the 2000s, I was already over it, or at least I am over it now if I watch it. But let's hear what Ben has to say, and then we can get back into this.
For Cynthia, do it. For Cynthia. May she rest in peace. Do it. For the old days. Do it.
All right, so Ben from Filmbusters, he's traveling right now, so he didn't have time to rewatch the movie, but he just sent me this. He says, between buckwheats and boat drinks, you won't find a more well-meaning, dialogue-driven, well-acted offshoot of the Tarantino crime subgenre. I think it sadly got lost in that cavalcade of 90s offbeat indies that every film student with a camera tried to make following Pulp Fiction. But this really has a lot more heart than most. A cast of characters that, having not watched it in over a decade, are still seared into my mind. And such delicious lines as, add water, take my dick out. That is Christopher Walken, in case some of you couldn't place that line. Then he continues, you know, I love Andy Garcia too. That man had the world in his hands for a moment back there. It's one of his great roles for me. Has me daydreaming in many a dull work meeting, wishing he'd walk in and choke out one of our directors with his own tie. Also, fun fact, I think this was the movie that led me to the piece of trivia that Walken almost always insists on adding a dance scene before he will accept the part.
That's hilarious. I called that out in Trans Corner. Yep. I don't know if I've ever heard that, but yeah.
It makes sense. I've seen him dance a lot. So that would track.
Again, I'm sorry. When you're a crime movie, like a mob movie, and you're sandwiched in between Casino and Heat, it's I don't think it's really a surprise that you can get lost in the shuffle.
Do you think that it stood a chance, or it would have stood a chance if it was led by a more established leading man? Because I love Andy Garcia, but I don't think he's, you know, he's not Tom Cruise or Will Smith or like, I'm not saying it's his fault, but I'm saying that maybe you could survive that sandwich.
Well, I don't know about that. I thought you meant just in general, if this movie stood a better chance. having a mob movie come out the week after the new Scorsese mob movie, even in 1995, I think that's it's a pretty big hill to climb. And I think just generally speaking, you know, who fucking knows, but it's interesting to me that this came out in December of 95 when they easily could have just tried to push it back to January or February and maybe had a better go at the box office. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but back in the mid-90s, nobody was, you know, if they released your movie in January or February, that was the kiss of death. So the optics, I think, would have been bad. Like, nobody's going to go see it. But if you're releasing in December.
I was going to say, I assumed it was because From Dusk Till Dawn came out in January of 96, and they didn't want to be directly opposed from Tarantino's, you know, script.
I mean, I guess it's, I think it was a, I guess a no-win scenario, right? Like Gary Flitter was not the director. I mean, he wasn't established as he would be later. And Andy Garcia, he was known, but he was not. Here's what I was thinking, right? Just because Travolta got an Oscar nomination of Pulp Fiction. So if we was Travolta playing Jimmy here, you would get that star power and that prestige.
He was in White Man's Burden that came out on that same day.
How did White Man's Burden do?
I don't know. I've never seen that.
Yeah, but you know, Travolta leading a gangster movie, that seems more interesting than whatever is going on in White Man's Burden. Yeah. Because, you know, I'm thinking, you know, mid-90s Face Off, or I guess late 90s, but still, you know, Cage, Nicolas Cage as Jimmy. Then maybe you get people, because he was The Rock is later, right? What was he doing in 96? Was he about to win an Oscar, or he had just won an Oscar?
He would have just won it.
Okay.
The Rock was 96.
Oh, there you go.
Leaving Las Vegas was 95. So that it was the same year that came out, just a few months prior. I don't know, man. I can't tell you what would have fixed this. It is interesting because, like, in hindsight, is Christopher Lloyd the biggest name in this? As far as, like, well, Walken.
Yeah.
It's Walken, Lloyd, and probably Steve Buscemi.
I guess the overall point, though, is not so much like, oh, how you could you have fixed it, but just that I wonder if it would have more notoriety today if it was not an Andy Garcia vehicle, but rather a vehicle from a more recognizable actor, a more well-known actor. But then again, I mean, I don't know, like, how many people remember White Man's Burden, you know? So.
Big thing today is too, folks are way more into the idea of ensemble casts. Obviously, all movies have always had multiple people in them, you know what I mean? But like the idea of like the Soderbergh approach to it wasn't really hot yet, which that's kind of what this is. Pulp Fiction, and again, to go back to it, that obviously had a big quartet in it. But like Reservoir Dogs is the other Tarantino one that I'm kind of surprised there wasn't much comparison to, because honestly, the big scenes of dialogue in this feel more like hoisted from Reservoir Dogs than they do Pulp Fiction. But at the time that movie came out, who would have been the biggest name of that? Harvey Keitel?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, these names now are titans of the industry. But I think if they had more publicly advertised who was in it, there's a shot there too of turning your fortunes around. The poster is literally just Andy Garcia hate fucking you with his eyes.
So let's really dig into the Andy Garcia aspect of it, because I like him a lot in this movie, and
I like him sometimes in this.
When don't you like him?
The last act is too much, man. It's too much for me to act like we haven't gone off the rails.
Well, he has gone off the rails. So.
And while I think his acting is good, both in the mob shit and his dealings with women, I can't. It's so jarring when it goes to those scenes. It's so detached from the main story of it. And then when he gets Feruza pregnant at the end, it's like, what?
Okay, yeah, that's a bullet point that has its own separate life. But as far as the performance, I did not feel that, I guess, disconnect between his love subplot and his increasingly dangerous life with the mafia, return to the mafia. Because It's like I said in Contreras Corner. I feel like the movie from the very beginning establishes that he's living this double life, obviously against his will, right? He was trying to be done with that side of, you know, with the crime side of his life, and he's been dragged back in. And so I buy it. I think it helps that he's just really good, I think, at doing both, at being very charismatic. And I found it captivating that his scenes with Dagny, I don't remember the name of the actress, but you know, her, that courtship, which could have been really boring. I was like, man, they're playing really well off each other. And I think it kind of, he goes a little too far at the end when he's saying goodbye to her towards the end, and he starts laying it on really thick. Like almost like he's quoting poetry to her. And I was like, it's too much, man. Just get out of there.
The other night, you're telling me we're on the brink of an exception.
You know how many people out there want a shot at bringing you paradise? They want to spend the rest of their days with you.
You're doing the talking thing again.
But I can't do it. I want to do that so badly. I can't do it.
But for the most part, I liked it. And my problem, and I don't know if it's the performance or if it's just the direction, the way that they frame the movie, but I felt that he was, he seemed a little too happy, like a little too content to just go along with whatever Christopher Walken was saying, you know, during that first half of the movie. Because obviously, once things go bad and his friends are in danger and all this, and he seems miserable. But at first, I understand that he has to play nice with Walken and his goons. And, you know, he's just smiling and kind of nodding at all the disparaging comments that Walken keeps throwing his way. But I would have liked to see just a glimpse of him and how much he hated it, right? But instead, he seems to find Christopher Walken kind of amusing, like that uncle that embarrasses you because he's just so close-minded and so conservative, maybe. but not somebody that you are like, I can't believe I have to sit next to this person or like be in the same room as this person. Instead, he didn't seem inconvenienced enough for me, like by the fact that Walken was putting this on him and having him go out of his way to scare Josh Charles and all this stuff. Like, I understand why he had to do it, right? There was no way to say no. But the fact that we never see him stop smiling, we never see under the facade that he's selling these gangsters, you know, oh yeah, I'm still one of you. Like, I think that would have made it more interesting if I had felt from the beginning that he really hated this life. But instead, it just feels like, oh, well, I guess I'm going back to it for a little bit longer. And that part is a bummer. But like I said, I don't know that's the performance, because I believe that Andy Garcia is fully capable of giving us that extra layer if he wanted to or if he'd been asked to do it. But instead, I think that the focus was like, no, we're going to play this guy as super smooth. Everything slides off of him until something happens that just won't, right? Then things get really bad. So I really like the performance. I think that what I'm saying is that I don't like the direction.
You were kind of talking about it, and I do want to call out too, this movie does do a good job of, the stakes are very low at the beginning. And it's like when he assembles his Avengers, you know, to go out here and do this case, things get out of control so fast and two people die, that it does a good job of, like, you're watching it and you're like, okay, these, you know, this isn't $1 million bet here. What are we doing? And then it's like, oh, fuck. And then I appreciate it seems really mundane and then takes a dramatic turn, you know, really quick. I was trying to like put my finger on what doesn't work about this for me. And I keep going to the tonal inconsistency. As far as Andy Garcia goes, to finish the train of thought on him, I think, he's definitely giving it his all here. We've watched a few things. Smoke and Aces immediately comes to mind as far as like, is the ink dry on my check? And that's fine. You know, when you're an actor like that, you know, you kind of earn the ability to have roles like that. I think he's solid in this. It's just, it's too all over the place. And I think the other performances in this kind of overshadow him, specifically Christopher Lloyd, William Forsythe, and Walken. Even as problematic as Walken's character and dialogue is, he comes across as a fucking evil son of a bitch in this. And, you know, yes. Walken by today's standards is he's kind of like Michael Caine. Everyone has an impression of him, and he's become almost through no fault of his own. Well, in Walken's case, yes, but it has become like almost a caricature of himself. You know what I mean? Yeah. But in the mid 90s, and you know, this watch, he was in Pulp Fiction, so he should be the closest one to have a say to it. He's nasty in this. Yeah. And for a movie that's kind of bordering on silly in some parts, every scene he had, I was like, man, he's a motherfucker, man.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a really good villain. I think that really helps setting the story, or what you were saying, right? The stakes are high because we know he's a son of a bitch. The dialogue, I do want to talk about it because I know, you know, it came up when we did Pulp Fiction all those years ago. And I remember at the time you felt more strongly about it than I do. And I think that that might still be the case. And I don't feel good about it, but I, you know, there's just something about slurs that don't, I think because they're not, I've never really have to suffer them. Even, you know, I'm Hispanic, but I can't think of a single time in my life that anybody has like dropped a Hispanic slur on me. And whenever I've heard them, I've just find them like this curiosity, which of course is very different from the point of view of somebody who's being constantly hurled slurs. So I know that that is, you know, that is my privilege, that I can just watch them or just listen to this dialogue and take the slurs and the really offensive things that they say as just punctuation and color. And I get it. You know, I get why it's offensive, but I get it on an intellectual level. At least, you know, when we're watching like Pulp Fiction, like Kill Bill, we just did Kill Bill, but that one, other than the Michael Madsen character, it's actually pretty toned down by Tarantino standards. But then Walken in this movie, it's like on a pretty high level, and it was making me uncomfortable at times. But a lot of it was just
well, for me too. And you know, going back to the discussions of Tarantino, and we do plenty of jesting about, you know, his dialogue and Django and his insistence on accents and the highly problematic character he was gonna play in Kill Bill, but you know, got away from. He still makes masterpieces, and I think that's why a lot of people come away from like just joking about how he likes to interject that into his script, because at the end of the day, his movies, they slap, as the kids say. And a movie like this, while there are parts of it that I enjoy and think overall it's, you know, a fine movie, it doesn't have a strong enough script or enough conviction in its story that it's telling for me to not see the repeated use of, like, really, like, hate speech is what it is, as kind of like there for shock value. Does that make any sense?
No, it does. And I'm really wrestling with the idea of, because the simplest thing to fall back on, and I think I might have even said it in Contreras Corner, is that, well, this was the 90s. And in a way, it's just like, well, that's how movie characters spoke in the 90s. A certain movie characters spoke in the 90s, right? And now I'm thinking of the Eurotrip episode where yeah, there's a lot of like offensive dialogue that's just there for, because back in the 90s, it was funny to use that. You know, that's what was considered comedy. It's like you make fun of somebody for being gay, and then you just kind of like write a whole speech about that. Like Walken has a monologue here where he's just basically asking Andy Garcia if he's turned gay yet, because he works with gay people, because his business is aimed at gay liberal people. I mean, he's using much more offensive language, but the bulk of it is that, you know. And I'm like, what goes through the mind of Scott Rosenberg while he's writing this? Is he writing as in like, this is an evil character, and so I'm going to have him utter these really hateful lines, you know? Or is he thinking, oh, this is just going to make it memorable? Right, what you're saying, the shock value is like, oh, I can't believe he said that. Or is there not even that kind of thought? And it's just like, oh no, but this is like the way that the bad guy in the 90s talks. So we're gonna do it. And if you're writing that kind of script today, you just don't go there, because now it just kind of turns people off more than, you know, whereas like in the 90s, audiences probably would have thought that it was funny. And that is, you know, at least for someone like me, which again, I have the privilege of not having those slurs like hit me really hard, but more like maybe cock an eyebrow, maybe I can appreciate the construction of the sentence, and I can appreciate like the delivery of the lines, and I can appreciate that how they punctuate certain things, but in the end it just feels unnecessary. I guess I don't feel the purpose. Even in something like Tarantino, maybe, yes, you're right, they're better movies to begin with, but also I think that it's less trivial the way that he does it, even though there's plenty of trivial conversations in the Tarantino universe. But I don't think mm-hmm. that the way that they use when he uses offensive language there, it doesn't usually feel like it's out there to be harmful, to hurt. And here, specifically, the walking character is really trying to hurt Andy Garcia whenever he says those things. And so maybe that also is, you know, and it's ultimately... I know we brought it up with Eurotrip, and I know it's come up in other movies, usually when it's from the 90s, just the idea that, you know, the ultimate insult is to tell a man that he likes men, you know, and that is exemplified here with the walking character. And it's just like, when we've come so far past that, to suddenly be taken back to that place, even when you know the context in which it was made, it's still a little jarring.
You people.
Yes, you people.
Homosexuals. You're not a homosexual now?
You people. You people. Every f***ing in the world is good at this kind of shit, and I gotta wind up with one that's clunky?
Okay, Jimmy.
There's a different take on it, or a different side of it, which also kind of like, you know, I scratch my head, but which is when Andy Garcia is the one using the slur when he's talking to a guy from Sex and the City.
Stanford,
right? Like, they're talking about the new ad.
Willie Gerson.
Yeah, and Andy Garcia is like, this is terrible. I thought you people were better than this. And Stanford goes like, what do you mean, you people? And then Andy Garcia drops the F word. And, you know, in that sense, that scene is painted as like, oh, well, they're buddies, and this is just them talking. And it's still kind of, you know, you wouldn't write that today. You wouldn't write it that way. You know, you can make the point that he's jabbing at him and telling him, well, the stereotype of a gay man is that you would be better at this. But they adding the slur there is like, are you doing it because that makes it sound more authentic because he used to be a gangster? Or are you doing it because that's just the way that movie characters were expected to speak in the 90s? So bottom line, I actually like the dialogue in this movie a lot, but the offensive parts were a little distracting just because it would send me off on these tangents of thought where I was like, all right, where are we with this?
Yeah.
How bad is it? How am I overthinking it? Am I underthinking it? So at the end, it becomes an obstacle, right? But there's some stuff that I think that's really fun dialogue, you know, a lot of the flirting between Andy Garcia and the main actress, and just the speech that Christopher Lloyd has, just beautiful. How do you feel about it? Do you have any other like bits of dialogue that you like? Or because I think that in the end I like how Scott Rosenberg writes. I think that, you know, that that might be part of it. But I know that, you know, whenever we watched Beautiful Girls, problematic subplot aside, like there was also, I think that I like the dialogue more than you did.
I think you just like that movie more than I did.
Well, yes.
I don't think I know that. the dialogue's largely good. Like, the movie's largely good. It's just that I find it a tad overambitious. And when the dialogue does go astray, or the subplots of the movie go astray, it's just overall not a strong enough movie to pull off those either, you know, kind of questionable moments or the hard lefts, as I like to say, the hard left or the hard right that the story takes. And it just seems to be a movie with a bit of an identity crisis. And the movie's saving grace is that the acting in it is so good, you know, and all the exchanges with like Andy Garcia when he's putting together his team, you know, all the William Forsythe, all the exchanges he has with him, and like the idea that his wife knows who he is and she hates him, won't even look at him. Yeah. And yeah, Christopher Lloyd, you know, bummed of where his life turned out, but proud of, you know, living a life that, you know, he at least experienced shit. Like, he did bad things and he knows that, but he commanded respect at one point in his life. And then Bill Nunn doesn't have too much to do. And I did not care for the Treat Williams character. I really? I cared like, I appreciated how hard he committed to it.
Yep.
Because he's going in 110%. I did like Steve Buscemi being the laconic hitman, just, you know, bit of a badass. And there's things to enjoy here. Renegade Don Cheadle showing up, and of course Debo. I meant that sincerely. I went Debo when he showed up, and Zeus.
Every time you find Debo in a new movie, it's like a treasure hunt.
So satisfying.
Yeah.
And yeah, Bob Pinciotti is one of the hired goons, was good shit. Yeah, Treat Williams, no.
That's weird because I am the opposite. I had trouble buying Buscemi as the badass contract killer. I think he's a great actor. I usually like him in movies, and I didn't dislike him here, but every time that he would get the better out of other people that were just as dangerous, I was like, really? Like, okay, I buy him showing up and killing Christopher Lloyd, but when he walks into what's the name of the guy from Showgirls?
Glenn Plummer.
Yeah, he walks into Glenn Plummer's lair and just exterminates everybody there. I'm like, come on. I don't feel like Steve Buscemi, who again is a great actor, I don't think he has the presence to make me buy that. On the other hand, Treat Williams, who I haven't seen in that many movies, but I've seen enough movies to kind of be impressed by how bulked up he is and how he sells the physicality of this idiot that he's playing. I didn't find him as amusing as the movie maybe wanted me to find him, but I still appreciated the role that he played. Like that crew that he assembles, that Jimmy assembles, they each have their own personality and they each have their things that they do, right? You have the family man, the loose cannon, the old guy that's falling apart and so on. So I appreciated the role that Treat Williams played.
Yeah, but he, for a movie that is almost trying to show you how real life is, the Treat Williams, the Bill, critical Bill, seems like he's like in a fucking Guy Ritchie movie or something. Like it's too much.
But you could say the same about Walken.
That's what I mean. This movie's trying to act like it's grounded in reality, so much so that this guy had a hit put out on him and he ended up in a wheelchair the rest of his life. Like it. You know, if this movie that the Critical Bill character exists in, Christopher Walken should have like an eye patch on and, you know, a pet of some sort.
Well, he has the next best thing, Alex. He has Jenny McCarthy.
Known idiot Jenny McCarthy. Yeah.
I was wondering how far we were going to go before Guy Ritchie's name popped up. Because, yeah, Tarantino overshadows all the other comparisons, but... I mean, Guy Ritchie is just, some people would call him maybe the British Tarantino.
Yeah, probably.
And he would hate it. Jack Warden. Like him. I like him. Don't care.
Oh, yeah. He's great. He's a great actor. I like the idea of this movie having like a presence of telling it in a retrospective form. You know, that's famously Goodfellas. I don't know if you've heard of that movie, Julio. But, some people liked it. And that's... part of what makes that movie so engaging is that it's being told from a past perspective. And that's kind of, you know, Jack Warden's kind of the Ray Liotta spirit here of letting us know.
Yeah, he's part of that world. He's guiding us through. I am surprised, honestly, at how well that works. Because when I realized what they were doing with that character, I was like, this is a little too whimsical for the movie. But then... when the ending is them in heaven on the boat, I'm like, this makes perfect sense.
And then Treat Williams said, well, where's Jackie Jr.? Where's my brother?
Before we get to the Farooza Balk pregnancy, because that's a separate thing, but I think that if I watch this movie again, which I probably will, because like I said, I own it now, or I own the right to stream it until it leaves Amazon Prime.
Yes.
Yes. I think that I might appreciate it more in the sense that now I know what it's about. I like the left turn of like, okay, the first hour is about the mission. And then the second hour is not even about survival, but more about just coming to terms with the fact that your time is almost up. And as I was watching it, I kept thinking, okay, but why are we watching this? What's the deal? What is the story about? Right? It's because it doesn't seem like Andy Garcia is too broken up about anything. And yes, by the end of the movie, he is, right? But then I think that Jock Warden kind of gives you that extra context of even gangsters can romanticize their lives, right? And that's what they all do. They all have these regrets, and they have to face them head on the moment that they realize that they're about to die. They're probably going to die. But this doesn't happen until halfway through the movie, which I think is why I was like a little confused on it, you know? And I could say that in a way, at least thematically, the movie doesn't start until they fuck up that mission and suddenly they're running out of time because Walken is going to have them all killed. Mm-hmm. And on rewatch, now that I know that that's what's happening, then I can appreciate that first hour as like purely set up. You know, it's not that it's just set up before they go into the mission, but the mission itself is just set up for the fact that the movie is really about men whose days are numbered. And that sounds really good. Like, I think that I'm going to enjoy it more that way, because I had a feeling that, yeah, they were all saying goodbye, but now you know that they're really saying goodbye. You know, Bill Nunn has that final conversation with Andy Garcia before he gets in the car, where he tells him about how life just flashes by.
Remember when you was a kid, you spend the whole fucking year waiting for summer vacation, and then finally come and just fly by just like that. Mm-hmm. It's funny, Jimmy. Life has a way of passing by faster than any old summer vacation.
And then, you know, Christopher Lloyd with his speech, even Treat Williams with his own like stupid way. You know, he has like this defiance against the idea that he could die, that this is how he goes, and so on. So I like that aspect of it. I think that the movie doesn't dig deep enough into that side of it. That's the movie that I would have liked to see. Mm-hmm. But man, I'll take half a movie about that instead of none at all. So that's good. Now the baby, Alex, talk to me about Andy Garcia's super powerful seed.
Yeah. I don't know where this came from or whose idea this was. This is, this seems like an idea that was thrown in late into production. Don't you think?
I guess it's so, like, logistically, it just seems like it doesn't work.
Who knows? Maybe it was in the script all along, and just even when the script was written, it just never really thought to address it until it was time. But it just seems real out of nowhere and from a different movie.
Yeah, first, I was going to make a joke I didn't get to, but I had it on my notes. I was going to compare Andy Garcia's powerful seed with that of Anthony Mackie's in Io, where they just one shot, that's all they needed. The difference and what makes this worse is that it's almost like he knows that she's going to get pregnant from them having sex that one time. Mm-hmm. You know, because he records a message for his unborn son, and it's not like she went and took a pregnancy test. You know, so was he just recording a message just in case? It seems kind of silly. Like, the idea that, you know, why does he decide to, I guess, to have a kid with this girl? Is it just because he needs to pass on his knowledge, his wisdom?
In that whole discussion about it, he mentions that, like, I've never thought about having a kid. And it almost seems like he's just doing it, like, as a charity thing for her.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
But then the charity angle falls apart a little when you see that he left this kid a tape or a recording, the 8 minutes.
Talks about how bad the world is.
Yeah. It's so weird, because it would have made more sense for me if he had left that message for her. Forget about the pregnancy. Just give her the money, tell her to get out of here.
Yeah.
And
find yourself a good man.
Yeah. 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 Just get out of this hellhole. Leave Denver. It makes more sense now, knowing that that's what they were going for, to have that side quest in the middle of the movie where he goes to defend her honor and all that. Because I felt at the time, I mean, I still do, that part also comes out of nowhere, where he's just been told by Christopher Walken, you have 48 hours to leave and I'm going to start killing your friends. And yet he finds the time to kind of cruise around and check on her and then go hunt down the guy that that beat her up and all that. I mean, I'm not saying that he shouldn't have, but it just felt like he had stopped the main story so he could go on this digression and then come back to it. But now I'm like, oh, they were setting up the fact that then the movie's going to end with them making a baby against all odds. It's so fucking weird. I really would like to hear Scott Rosenberg and Gary Fletcher explain this one to me, or just justify their decisions.
You explain yourself to me right now, sirs.
It's like, I've been defending your movie, but this is indefensible.
Overall, though, I mean, I'm pointing out a lot of things that don't work for me. I found this to be just a very fascinating movie. Even with the 2-hour runtime, I didn't feel it dragging at any point. I, you know, there's definitely some interesting things that we'll talk about in the warm-up video for this as far as trivia goes. But yeah, this is fine. And it's a really interesting movie to find kind of left in the wake of everything that was happening around it. And I enjoyed it. I'm glad Ben found it and threw it our way. It's not one that I would necessarily say, oh, you got to go out of your way to see it. But it's one of those, you know, like our film friends. If it was like, hey, you ever seen this? Like, the cast is fucking insane. And yeah, it has its issues, some of which are kind of glaring. But overall, it's a pretty interesting movie that was made at a time when there was repeated attempts to capture the magic of Point Break, like a great action movie, Terminator 2 or some shit, like the great action movies of the early 90s. But then also after the fucking revelation that was the Tarantino dialogue and, you know, what we got from that. Because, you know, the 90s still, we still had things like to come, like I mentioned Con Air and Men in Black and these movies that are just by the books 90s action films. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until we got to like the early 2000s and through the 2000s that we saw as many of these. You know, I thought of London at one point with this. London's obviously not much of an action movie, but one of those where the person writing it so clearly wants to have just that fucking razor sharp dialogue. And when that works, just like this movie, there's parts of it where it works. It's like, huh. And then there's other parts where it doesn't. And it's like, ugh. And this is such a snapshot of a period in time of Hollywood that in and of itself to me, like I give it the thumbs up of just thinking like for historic, I almost feel like the phrase historical context is important when it comes to a movie like this.
Submitting it for preservation.
Exactly. Get the National Film Registry on it and I'll write the, put it in the Criterion Collection and I'll write the essay as to why it deserves inclusion. In closing here, before we get to our reviews, just in some of my research, I found a fun, the City of Denver website, denver.org. There was a blog entry on it from March 1st of 2022 that just recounted the movies and TV shows that were filmed in Denver. And one of them mentioned is Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead. And it starts with this because we're just not going to escape it. So it's proper to close with it. In the Tarantino tinged. Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead. A motley crew roams its titular city with Andy Garcia, Treat Williams, Christopher Lloyd, Christopher Walken, and Steve Buscemi in the cast. Notable locations include Denver Union Station and Bluebird Theater. And tinged, of course, meaning having a very slight amount of color or feeling. So even Denver.org was saying, yeah, we get what you were going for here.
I'll tell you what, though, as you were talking about the dialogue and all that stuff and all the other movies, something that this movie doesn't do that a lot of Tarantino clones try to do is insert pop culture conversations in their story.
Yeah,
and I was glad that this one didn't do it. I mean, yeah, it does have the you know, where it goes Tarantino is in the monologues, right? Like, it'll set up things so that characters can have these big monologues. The story stops so they can just go on, and then they have, you know, some of the casual exchanges. Like, criminals usually don't talk this much, or at least they didn't used to before the 90s. But no, they're not talking about McDonald's or you know, Superman or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. The conversations are a little more focused on what's going on, and I actually appreciated that, because that's one of the worst things in Tarantino imitators. It's like when they can't pull off the pop culture conversations, because then it's just like, yeah, nobody gives a shit, you know. You have to write it really well in order for me to care about what they call the quarter pounder with cheese in Amsterdam. And if you don't have that, then just don't do it. Just focus on this story. One last thing before we give our scores, because I haven't, you know, I didn't have the name. Gabrielle Anwar, that's the name. You called her out on Concerns Corner. But yeah, that's the main actress here who plays Dagny. And I think she's really good. And it looks like she's had a career since. I mean, not blockbusters, but it's not like she peaked with this. I guess she was, I'd never seen Scent of a Woman, but it looks like she was the love interest in Scent of a Woman.
Oh, right on.
Yeah. At least I see her dancing with Pacino in some of these pictures. So looks like there's something going on there. But anyway, Alex, what is your final score for Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead?
I think we're going to go with a C+. When I log this on Letterboxd, that's looking probably 3 stars. Depending on how I feel waking up in the morning after this conversation, between 2.5 and 3 stars. What about yourself?
I am a little more charitable. I'm like Andy Garcia with Fruzo Balk. I'm going to be like, I'll give you that extra 0.5 star.
There you
3.5 for me. I really like the Andy Garcia performance. I think he's very, very smooth. It's funny because you see
effortless.
But you see him today, right? Like I see Andy Garcia in movies today and he's just, now he's an adult and he's just playing the man in his 50s roles and 60s, whatever. And he does those well, but you get thrown back into the 90s. It's like, oh yeah, he was a hunk. And he was the kind of guy that would just walk up to a girl in a bar and spit some lines and you can buy that she would be interested.
Oh yeah.
So that was really cool to see. Because, you know, when we did Desperate Measures, that's what it was called, right? Desperate Measures. He was a lot more tense in that movie. So he didn't have time to be charming. But in this one, he does. And he's, every time he flashes a smile, whether it is to Dagny or it is to the mobsters and whatever, you can be like, yeah, this guy, he was, there's a reason why Jack Warden is still talking about him at that diner. You know, he was a special figure. So I think that he sells that very well. And everybody else, like we said, we've been praising it. The rest of the cast. So 3.5 for me, a C plus for Alex. That's not too bad. I don't know what Ben's score is.
I saw on Letterboxd he gave it 4 stars.
Okay.
Yeah.
4 stars from Ben on Letterboxd, apparently. So that's good. If you watch Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, let us know what you thought. But it's time for us to move on, Alex.
It's just the way we shake hands. We fresh palms up front like that. You know why? Because when we were locked down. In the visitor's room, they had this clear plastic divider that separated you from your visitor. And you used to touch them hello and goodbye like that.
What is up next, Julio?
Up next, another patron pick. This is from Katie and OT. We're giving us the movie Mad Heidi. 84% on Rotten Tomatoes. I don't know anything about it. Other than it has been much celebrated by them on their own show. And also Katie told me that it was weird, but weird in a good way. Let's hope we agree.
Not, of course, to be confused with Mad Heine.
No, is that the porno version? Is that the one that they show at Christopher Lloyd's?
I couldn't settle an actor and actress on that has like a great ass, because Jennifer Lopez would have been too easy to go to. So Hugh Jackman, Mad Heine, the story of Hugh Jackman.
Why not?
Yeah.
That will be the after hours, but the main feed is Mad Heidi. So check that out before our next episode. I don't even know where it's streaming, but I'm sure it's easy to find. But that's it. Alex, let's get out of here.
Boat drinks?
Boat drinks.
Welcome to our end credits.
Or as we usually call them, our perennial plugs.
We start off by giving thanks to the Festive Years who provide our opening and closing tracks. They kick us off with Last Stand and take us home with Summer of 99. Be sure to head over to thefestiveyears.com for any and all Festive Years needs.
Our friend and fellow podcaster Hans Rothgeiser is the man behind our logo and all the art you see related to our show. Reach out to him and let him know how much you like that little tomato. His email address is mildemonios@hotmail.com and his website is mildemonios.pe. That's M-I-L-D-E-M-O-N-I-O-S. You can also check out his podcast, Nación Combi, about Peruvian current affairs, and Marginal, about economy. Hans, thank you for all your support.
For those interested in the regularly absurd world of professional wrestling, Joe and the boys over at LateNightGrin.com have you covered. Tell them the Contrarian sent you.
And we'd like to close with special thanks to our social media team of Zoe Perez and Corey Ari. Each of the social media accounts we mentioned in the introduction look as good as they do because of their work.
So that'll do it for this episode of The Contrarians, where we're right and you're wrong, and we will catch you next time.